You guys have put together some amazing introductions for us. I think that I'm almost wondering if that was me that got introduced. As a member of the organizing committee, I also want to thank all of you for being here from such diverse places in the country. I hope you're getting a lot out of the meeting. I know I think, I don't want to brag, but we've had some great speakers, haven't we? And we've gotten very fortunate with the quality of speakers that we've had here. So with that said, I've got 30 minutes and I've got 40 minutes worth of stuff, so I'm going to talk fast. I better not waste any more time. That was a joke, of course. So when we talk about supplementation practices and wanting to be sure you get the biggest bang for your buck from the money you spend on supplements to feed to your cows on your home place, there's really two aspects about that that I want to visit with you about today. First is the biology, the cattle production part, the part that myself, as a ruminant nutritionist, likes to talk about, you know, what is the right nutrient to be in that supplement that's going to augment whatever nutrients are in the main forage that we're expecting those cows to live on primarily. And then there's another aspect of the best bang for the buck, and that's the buck itself, the economics of pricing it right in terms of all the choices you have that's a potential supplement that will provide that nutrient. Now, these two aspects aren't a one or the other thing. In reality, both are really important to maximizing the value of your supplementation program. So through today's talk, we're going to talk about both of those. So let's talk first about the biology. And yes, that screen does lag the other screen, so you can't stand up here and, yeah, it's wireless. So I guess I'll this is why we have a monitor to cheat with. So when we're talking about supplementing cows, we obviously don't need to supplement cows on green grass situation. Green grass has a lot of nutrients in it. And if your cows are still running deficient in nutrients in the summer, spring and summer on green grass, then you've got management issues other than supplementation, and we're not going to talk about that today. What we are going to talk about is a situation like this scene. This is a winter scene. There's not snow on the ground, but trust me, I took that picture in the dead of winter, and that is dormant, totally mature forage that those cows are expected to live on in a winter grazing program. And that's the situation where we most need to think we're probably deficient in some nutrients, and we need to think about a supplement to help those cows take care of themselves through a winter of living on that low-quality forage. So let's define what we mean by low-quality forage. And in general, the age-old rule that we as nutritionists have used is if it's got 7% or less crude protein. And this is a fairly... This isn't a one-size-fits-all rule. There's so many things can drive whether you really can. Sometimes you can get by with quite a bit less than this because you've got forage that cured off with a much higher protein content or a much more digestible forage as a higher quality dormant forage. In other words, all dormant forages are not created equal. There's other forages that when they go dormant, they are either far lower than that in crude protein content that, or the availability of the remaining protein in the forage is fairly unavailable, and you probably need to set this rule higher than this. But on the average, 7% is a nice starting number to be thinking about. And so that creates our first deficiency that we need to talk about today. The other important thing to understand is that these forages cured off a lot of the soluble nutrients, and if it's perennial grasses and so forth, were pulled back down to the roots to save for next year. And we left all the fiber and so forth that created the structure of that plant so that it's still standing out there in the plant. The beauty of ruminants is that they can digest that fiber and use that as their primary energy source. So there's energy out there, and that's key to today's talk. There's energy out there. We just have to make sure that that cow has the capacity to digest that fiber and use it. And I'm going to talk about this from a grazed forage standpoint because that's my primary interest. But everything I say can apply to harvested low-quality forages as well in terms of things like baled crop residues and so forth. So let's talk about what has to go on in the digestive tract of a ruminant animal to digest that energy and what the limitations are and what the really neat things that are real positives about feeding low-quality forage to beef cows are. And so a brief lesson in ruminant nutrition here. And the point is not to bore you with a college-type lecture, but the point is to deepen your understanding of why we choose to use the supplements that contain the nutrients we did and help you to make better informed decisions about what the right supplement purchase is. Well, the neat thing in the ruminant is the four-compartment stomach, with each compartment serving different functions to digest feed. The key compartments we're going to talk to about today are the first two, the reticulum and rumen. And in combination, those two compartments, and this is a view of those two compartments inside the cow, are where microbial fermentation happens. And let me orient you to the picture before I move on too far. Imagine you're standing on the left side of your squeeze chute looking at the side of your cow, and you've got Superman x-ray vision, and you look inside her, and this is what you see if you could look inside the rumen and it was empty so you could see it as an empty organ. So the way this thing works is that that's a big tank full of a solution that contains millions or billions or sometimes trillions of microorganisms. And the neat thing about these microorganisms is they help that cow digest that fiber. We'll talk a little bit more about that. The key reason for showing you the picture is I want you to understand how this thing works for driving that fermentation process. At the left end of the picture, you see that little piece of, looks like a tube sticking out between the letters B and C. That's the esophagus. It is a tube. It's what connects the mouth to the stomach, and that's where the food enters the reticulum-rumen combination. And the interior of that tube dropping in is where that letter 1 is there, just inside the rumen from the esophagus. Now look straight down the picture. Below the 1, you pass over the number 2, and you should see a number 3 down there. That number 3 is pointing out a small hole in the rumen, which we call the omasal orifice. It's the opening to the omasum, or the third compartment of the stomach. That's the only way food leaves the rumen. It's got to fit through a really small hole. And so the only way that we empty that rumen after a cow has eaten feed is that she digests the feed to the point the particles get small enough to fit through that small hole. Now, that's a double-edged sword. One thing means that the feed stays there till she's done with it and got what she can out of it. The other problem is the feed stays there till she's done with it. And sometimes, as we're going to learn in low-quality forages, that's a long time. So what's the value of this fermentation? Well, the value is the microbes produce enzymes that can digest fiber. The cow herself cannot digest fiber any different or better than a monogastric animal such as a pig or your dog or your cat or ourselves as humans. We can't digest fiber. We need it in our diets to keep our guts healthy, but we can't digest it. The microbes digest it for the cow. They release the energy from the fiber by digesting it, and then to keep the microbes alive, the cow shares the energy that's released with the microbes. The microbes take some, they leave an end product that's useless to them called volatile fatty acids, which is part of what's left of those carbohydrates that fiber is made of. The cow absorbs those VFAs through the rumen wall, and that's her source of energy. So everybody benefits from this relationship. At the same time, when we digest that fiber, it has encased at the cellular level in the forage, it has encased other good nutrients like starch and sugars, lipids, meaning fat, and other nutrients. But the neat thing is all of these nutrients that get released then become available for digestion and are additional sources of energy shared by the microbes in the cow. A bunch of other neat things happen in the rumen that we don't have time to talk about today in terms of the microbes synthesizing protein for the cow and synthesizing vitamins. But that's all you're going to hear about those because they're another story for another day. So let's think about that fermentation vat like a water tank. We got an inlet pipe in the esophagus dumping water in, like in the top of this picture here. We've got a float valve, tells it when the tank's full and shuts the water off. In a cow consuming a low-quality forage diet, what acts as the float valve is that there's nerve receptors in that rumen wall. And when you start to stretch them because the rumen's full of feed, they act just like a float valve. They send a message to the brain that says, stop eating. We're full down here, and it's going to start hurting if you eat too much, just like we're all going to do to ourselves next week for Thanksgiving dinner. Now, that stuff is stuck in there till we digest it and reduce particle sizes so it can leave there through that omasal orifice. And so we're going to have to digest it by the microbial action and by the fact that ruminants chew their cud to get those particle sizes smaller. The nutrients will get digested and absorbed through the rumen wall, so that one pipe exiting from the bottom of the tank on the left is one way we get that material out of the rumen, is by passing it through the rumen wall. And the other way is by reducing particles so they pass on down through the rest of the stomach and the small intestine. The rates that we digest that feed and we pass that feed out of the rumen determine when that rumen empties, so the float valve backs off, drops back down and allows that cow to eat again. With lower quality forages, high in fiber, that digestion process is slower, that particle size breakdown is slower, so rates of digestion and passage slow down as quality goes down. And here's some examples of different qualities of forages. Top of the page is the highest quality forage. When I say lush pasture, I mean really new green leafy pasture in the spring, the best stuff that your cows are ever going to see. And then we drop down the page and we go to the lower quality pasture, and then good to moderate to low quality hay. And then at the bottom, we got cereal straw. That's a pretty typical value of digestibility for, say, wheat straw that's not been treated to improve its quality or anything like that. Notice that digestibility gets cut nearly in half as we go from our best forages to a low quality forage like winter dormant feed. Notice that intake drops because that digestion has gone down and particularly has slowed down. Intake gets hurt dramatically. Notice that that's nearly a threefold decrease in intake as expressed on a percent of body weight of the cow basis. So we got two bad things going on here. We're getting less nutrients per pound of forage consumed, and the cow can only eat a lot fewer pounds than we'd like her to. So that drives the next question. What should we expect of our supplement then? Well, first, of course, we know we're deficient in some nutrients, so it should provide some additional nutrients. But we couldn't afford enough supplement to just meet that cow's nutrient requirements. We have got to help her do a better job of getting more out of that fiber that was left in that dormant forage. We need to overcome those limitations on digestion and intake. And the key to that then is to help those microbes do a better job of doing their job of digesting that fiber. So one of the keys I want you to take away today is when we're feeding a cow, we're feeding for two. And in one way, you know, you think of feeding for two means she's a pregnant mom. But in reality, I'm not talking about baby now as the second one of feeding for two. I'm talking about the rumen microbes as the other part of feeding for two. We need to meet their requirements first if we have a ghost of a chance of meeting the cow's requirements. So we think about meeting requirements of microbes. That's where that 7% number comes in. That's really their requirement, minimum requirement, not the cow's minimum requirement. So some factors that will affect our success at that then is to choose the right type of supplement. By type, I mean what are the nutrients in it. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about appropriate feedstuffs to provide whatever nutrient we think is most important, and then we'll finish up with some comparative pricing to get the best value for that particular nutrient. So we generally classify supplements for the purposes we're talking about today as either protein or energy supplements. We do this based on their protein content. A protein supplement is that because it's relatively high in protein content. an energy supplement. Is that not because it's high in energy? It is, but because it's low in protein. So we can't use it a protein supplement, so we call it an energy supplement. They both contain both protein and energy. It's just the relative amounts of each that we create our definition based on. So which of those should we be considering? I hope a lot of you already know this, and I hope a lot of you are already following my rabbit trail here about what that nutrient's going to be. Remember, we said a low-quality forage is tremendously low in crude protein content, at or less than 7%. Another definition that ruminant nutritionists have dreamt up for this is to do the ratio of TDN as a measure of energy, total digestible nutrients, the ratio of that to protein in the diet. And the higher that ratio is, the more energy we have relative to protein. And when we get greater than 7 for that ratio, we're in a protein deficient situation. We don't have enough protein relative to the energy value. And of course, we're still talking about a high fiber forage. So what do we need to do? Well, I hope you figured out by now. I'm going to tell you that protein is the first limiting nutrient in this situation. That energy's there. Energy isn't a limiting nutrient if we can just stimulate microbes. So let's give them some protein and grow some more microbes. And that's exactly what's going to happen if we provide a protein supplement. The microbes are actually going to take that feed protein, digest it all the way down to the element nitrogen that defines it, that it is protein, rebuild that nitrogen into new protein that they then use to grow more microbes. We call it microbial protein because it's actually the bodies of the bacteria and protozoa and yeast and so forth that are the microbes living in the rumen. If we can grow more microbes, then we can digest more fiber. And we can increase the rate that we digest it. When you go from millions to billions of microbes, you can increase the rate you get things done quite dramatically. And if we can increase those rates of digestion and passage, then we empty the tank faster and the cow can eat more. So we've fixed the limited intake problem. We've fixed the limited nutrient quality problem, at least partially. In nutrition, we call these interactions among feeds where one influences another and changes its base nutritional value. We call that interaction an associative effect. And of course, we like a positive effect where we increase the nutritional value. And in this example, we're increasing the nutritional value of the base forage by adding the protein in the form of a supplement. Now, unfortunately, we can also cause negative associative effects, and this is how. We feed them a grain-based energy supplement. We go get into the corn bin or the barley bin or whatever bin of grain is handy. The problem is that those grains are mostly starch, and starch competes with fiber to be digested in the rumen, and starch wins the war every time for a number of reasons. First, if we didn't first overcome the protein deficiency, we can't grow more new microbes to do digestion. Second, there's many different species of microbes. Some digest fiber, some digest starch. We're going to end up with more starch-digesting ones and less fiber-digesting ones. So now the fiber's being ignored. And third, even the fiber-digesting organisms will preferentially digest starch first and then after it's gone, switch to the fiber. If I hand you all a Snickers bar and a celery stick, which one are you going to eat first? Most of you are going to eat the Snickers bar because you know the celery stick just doesn't taste as good. Well, that's like starch versus fiber to a rumen microorganism. So we depress fiber digestion, we slow down rates of digestion, we slow down rate of passage, and therefore we decrease intake. Well, all we've done is supplemented the energy they're going to get out of that starch for the energy they should have gotten out of the base forage, and all that stuff's never getting digested, and it's coming out of the back end of the animal as underutilized forage. We call that a negative associative effect. It's an interaction between feeds where when you add one feed in combination with another, you depress the quality of the one you were hoping to get more out of. We want to avoid that. I'd like to show you a little bit of research data to give you a sense of how this looks in terms of the magnitude of the changes we cause with these feeds. Let me set this table up for you and tell you the story behind this experiment. So this was work done at Kansas State University, which is in the heart of Tallgrass Prairie Country in eastern Kansas. So these guys literally went out in there on their range unit and harvested a bunch of tallgrass prairie forage, took it back into campus, put some halterbroke steers in stalls, and fed the stuff to these steers. And they weighed everything the steers ate, and they weighed all the feces that came out of the steer, and that's how we measure digestibility, is we assume that if it disappeared in the animal, it was nutrients that they digested and absorbed. So they set up these steers with four sets of four steers who got each of these different treatments representing this column. One set of unlucky steers got no supplement. That's the 0% crude protein in the supplement column. And then they created these blends with 12, 27, or 41% protein. And the way they did that is they used mixtures of milo grain, a starch-based energy grain feed, and soybean meal, an excellent protein feed. To get 12% crude protein, it's almost all milo grain and virtually no soybean meal. It's a grain-based energy supplement. As you step it up to 27 and 41% crude protein, you have protein supplements. You got enough protein to promote a positive associative effect. And you can see that in fiber digestion. It was depressed by the energy feed at 12% protein, and not a great boost in digestion, but a slight boost in digestion in this particular study. You'll notice a small depression in intake by the 12% supplement, and notice at 0.9 to 0.8% of body weight, these are low intakes. So increasing them by nearly half with those higher levels of protein in the supplement was a dramatic increase in the amount of feed that those steers were consuming and digesting. So we got what we wanted in this particular study. There's been a lot of similar studies like this one done worldwide, and the results are almost universal. Sometimes we do a better job of getting a boost in digestion. Sometimes we measure a better boost in intake, but we almost always see negative effects from the low protein supplements and positive effects from the high protein supplements. At the same time, they had some gestating beef cows out on that same pasture. They ran the swather in to harvest the feed for the steer trial, and they fed similar supplements to those cows. The only difference was they didn't have a no supplement treatment because they knew the cows needed something. Notice that as you increase the protein content, you improve performance. They cut the weight loss and the body condition score loss in half. Now, you might sit there and say, but those are all tremendously awful cow performances. This study was done in a tough winter, and so cows were generally doing poorly that winter, and the fact that we could cut the negative effect in half is a pretty substantial improvement. And it showed up in the ultimate measure, economically important measure of cow performance, and that is pregnancy rates after the next breeding season and the fall after this supplementation was done were improved with both of the protein supplements relative to the energy supplement. So let's switch gears a little bit and say, well, what kind of feedstuffs work for this? And I'm going to list some examples, but there's way more feeds that I could list in this thing. And as we go into the future, more manufacturing processes with various crops and so forth will happen. And we'll have something new like the ethanol industry will come along, and we'll have new byproduct feeds. And the first thing you're all going to be faced with is a feed dealer wanting to sell you some new novel byproduct feed that you've never heard of. I want to give you more of a sense of what you should look for in terms of nutrient profiles that make it look like this new feed has potential. So this is high protein feeds. Corn grain is on there not to say it's a high protein feed. It's on there for reference. I'm going to have it on about three slides here with lists of various feeds. Notice that corn grain is 9% crude protein. It's an energy feed. These things have a five-fold higher level of protein. The oilseed meals like these and many other meals left after oil extraction from oilseed crops make our best high-protein protein supplements. But they don't to be a protein supplement, they don't necessarily have to be this high in protein. I'll call these moderate protein. They're more in the upper teens and up to 30%, not at that nearly 50% level. All various byproduct feeds of various milling industries or some kind of a production industry all work really well as protein feeds. Notice that the TDN levels in these feeds are really quite high, right up there with the corn in most cases. They're good sources of energy too, but once again, we're still keying on protein as the nutrient deficiency we need to overcome. And then here's energy feeds. Corn grain's still on there to represent grains in general, but there's a couple of byproduct feeds on there that make good energy feeds, soy hulls and sugar beet pulp. The difference here is they're not starch-based. These are sources of highly digestible fiber. And for those of you that are here yesterday, you heard Carly Jenkins talk about highly digestible fiber as being important supplements for cows in confinement. If we have cows that we augment the use of the fiber, but let's say she's a thin cow or a young cow who's still growing and still needs more energy even after we've augmented fiber digestion, these fiber-based byproduct energy feeds are the sorts of things we should look at rather than starch-based supplements such as grain. There's tables in your book that show the difference in nutritional response between using corn grain as an energy supplement or soy hulls in cows grazing dormant winter range. And the difference is dramatic. In the interest of time, I'm going to leave it for you to look in the proceedings and take a peek at that stuff yourself. So now that we know we got these classes of feeds that have various levels of protein, we want to focus on moderate to high protein content. Now we want to talk about how do you decide which one you should do. Let's say you can go to town and you can buy either some distiller's grain or you could use some alfalfa hay you produced on the place. We all know alfalfa can be quite high in protein. Or you can do a variety of things. Well, so let's say it's distiller's grains at around 29 to 30% protein versus soybean meal at nearly 50% protein. How do you compare those as to which the best one to price is? Well, you got to price it for the nutrient you want, not just the overall feed stuff itself. So let's convert the prices on a bunch of feeds to the price, the delivered price, not the price at the store or at the ethanol plant or wherever, on a crude protein content, since protein is what we care about. If we were looking for an energy feed, we could do this on a per unit of TDN or net energy. And we also need to make sure and get them on the same dry matter content because some of these things are wet feeds like wet distiller's grains versus dry feeds like dried distiller's grains or alfalfa hay. Or it could be a silage versus a hay. And we calculate the price per ton of pure crude protein. And it'll look like this. Here's a variety of feeds. And by the way, these feeds are priced. I priced them on Saturday when I put the talk together. So these are new as of Saturday. These are not delivered prices because I didn't know whose place to decide to deliver them to. These are at the point of origin where you'd buy them. So these still need to be adjusted for delivery. But we can start a comparison here. These are fresh as of 3 days ago, 4 days ago. These are different than the ones in your book that were relatively appropriate 2 months ago when we had to submit the proceedings for the book. Price, you'll notice if you're comparing your book to this, prices of feeds have gone down quite a bit over the last couple months. Over there in the right-hand column is the numbers we care about. The price per ton of protein that we get to deliver to the cows to meet to overcome their protein deficiency. In this table, wet distiller's grains is the winner at only $376 per ton of protein versus any of those other feeds. That's at the ethanol plant. These are POET nutrition prices. So this is some POET-owned ethanol plant in South Dakota that these are priced at. We're going to talk about delivery here in the next couple slides. A couple points I want to make before we move on. An important one is notice I put both 20% range cake as in a cube-based commercial range cake to provide protein versus a 30% cake. Notice that while the 30% cake costs more on a per ton basis, which they virtually always do, it costs less, nearly $60 less on a per ton of crude protein basis. In 30 years of being a nutritionist, I've never calculated this comparison and had it come out that the 20% cake was the cheaper source of protein. Where I don't know if it had ever switched up, but we're all, as far as I know, we're always better off if we're looking for protein to buy the higher percent commercial protein feed. The tub is on there, 20% per tub. This is like a cooked molasses type tub. I'm not trying to beat up on tubs. I'm sure there's some feed guys in the audience that are going, is he going to do this to us again? They are expensive for the protein you get. I don't want to just beat up on tubs by saying they're expensive. Sometimes there's other reasons that they're valuable. Sometimes when you got to go a long ways, the highly concentrated form they come in makes delivery better. Sometimes they work well. We know that there's good evidence that they work well for placement to improve distribution. So there's reasons to use tubs because they do more than provide protein. That's another story for another day. To price wet versus dried distillers grains, we got to get the protein valuation on an equal weight basis, especially if we're hauling them very far. Because, and I'm not going to go through this line by line, it's in the book, but when you figure the cost of hauling water, and you've already got water on your place, you're paying for something you don't need to haul in a truck. You want to price it based on the cost to haul the dry matter in the feed. That's 18 cents per ton of dry matter for dry distillers, 44 cents for wet. You could argue about whether my trucking price is right. You own your own truck, it's free. No, it's not. You got to pay the depreciation on the truck and the fuel bill. So they might be less than a commercial rate like that, but you still got to cover it. I calculated a break even based on those two comparisons. If you live within 58 miles of the ethanol plant, you're better off buying the wet because you're hauling it a short enough distance that the difference, the lower price is worth it. If you're more than 58 miles away, you're better off buying dry because you're hauling dry product further. Through the past 10 years or so, I've recalculated this thing pretty frequently, and it usually comes out in this 50 to 60 mile range. Back when corn was $7 or $8 and distillers grain prices shot up along with it, it actually got to be a longer distance. You could haul wet out to about 100 miles, but that's the most extreme I've ever seen. Typically, you got to be pretty close to the plant for wet to be worthwhile. I'm not going to talk about alternatives. It's in your book. We can cheapen up protein supplements in the right situation. Rumen microbes can use non-protein nitrogen to make microbial protein, but there's limitations. And alfalfa hay, I already mentioned, can be used as a protein supplement. So I'm about to get yanked off the stage by the sheep crook that Dr. Pond's hiding over here. So my conclusions are we got to think we can manage both the biology of how that supplement helps the cow and the economics of pricing that supplemental protein in this example, the cheapest we can get protein for, to maximize the bang for the buck. And that's the story I wanted to tell today.